Today we're chatting with Ashley Fell about work wellbeing. Ash is a social researcher, author, TEDx speaker and the Director of Communications at McCrindle, an internationally recognised research agency. Ashley and Mark McCrindle, the Managing Director of McCrindle, have recently launched their latest book, Work Wellbeing. It explores what work wellbeing is, why it's important and how to achieve it, whether you're an employee, a manager or a business owner. So enjoy the chat. Welcome to My Millennial Career. My name is Shelley. I'm a HR professional. Hello, Em.
Hello, Shell. I'm Emily and I work in recruitment and customer experience for a business called Foresights Recruitment and HR.
Today on the show, we're joined by Ashley Fell. Hey, Ash, how are you?
Yeah, I'm doing really well. Thank you. How are you both?
We're good as well. Thank you so much for coming and having a chat with us today.
Ash, you're the communications director with McCrindle and you've recently launched a new book called Work Wellbeing. Can you tell us what sort of brought about you deciding to write this book?
Yeah, so I've been with McCrindle for almost 7 years, which is quite a long time in the scheme of things. And being a millennial myself, that's like double the average tenure that someone normally stays in one role, which some of the data and all the fun facts that I know being working in a research agency. And so Mark and I have been working really closely together for particularly the last few years. And a big part of our role prior to COVID was going out and speaking at lots of different conferences. And my role as the communications director there is to help give a voice to all the fun and interesting and really important research that we get to do at McCrindle, which is a real privilege. And it's fascinating because I guess we've been talking about some of these topics that we really delve deep into in the book around work and well-being and culture and leadership and purpose and leading thriving teams. And we actually were approached by a publisher at the beginning of last year who saw some of our stuff and said, we think this is a really great topic. We'd love for you to write a book and we'd love to publish it. So that's how it kind of came about.
Can you give us your version of what wellbeing means and why it's even important? Because you're so right. That is a word that is so popular. It's, dare I say, thrown around quite commonly. And it'd be really nice to hear, how would you define it? You've been through this book writing process, but you also come from that research background. So share with us your insights.
Yeah, so it's absolutely, that's the case. Wellbeing is kind of, I feel like, this philosophical common term that everyone talks about just to describe their health. And it's kind of, I think, something that everyone thinks they should have a handle on, but no one really knows how to define it. I mean, we look at the first chapter in the book is sort of what is work wellbeing. And I guess just to draw on to start with, you know, the World Health Organization's definition of well-being is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, not merely the absence of disease, which I think a lot of us already know. And then in the book, we looked at all these different facets of well-being. And for us, we really define well-being as someone who is thriving in various aspects of their life. And to help explain that, we've got a few different models and visuals in the book. And one of them that I really find helpful to explain well-being in all its different facets is this well-being wheel that we've created. And it looks at four different areas of our well-being, from the personal well-being that we have, which is kind of our physical health and fitness, to our mental and emotional and spiritual well-being, to our interpersonal aspects. That's kind of our family relationships and our social relationships with our friends, our financial well-being, so that idea of the current earnings that we need to pay off mortgages and pay off the cost of living in Australia, and then the security, that's that longer term future financial aspect. And then there's that vocational element of well-being, which is more around the impacts that we have with our work and the purpose that work enables us to have. And so that's kind of well-being, like in and of itself, that's how we've sort of defined it and been able to try and describe it. But then we've kind of coined this new term, work wellbeing. And it's funny, the other day my mum was like, I love your new book, Workplace Wellbeing. And I was like, Mum, it's not called Workplace Wellbeing, it's called Work Wellbeing. And so, because that's workplace wellbeing is a really common term that everyone uses and knows. But for us, we wanted to look at the role of work in our lives, elevate it because it's so important. It's not just something that we do, it's not just drudgery, you know, that we've got to work these 5 days to get to the weekend, which some people do if they're not in an enjoyable role or in a great place with their work. But we wanted to, yeah, really expand the idea. And it's, you know, work well-being is more than workplace well-being, which I think typically is the ergonomic furniture, the workplace right. practices, whereas work well-being is sort of more a philosophical culture, leadership, intentional aspect. And I'm glad we did because, again, a lot of people aren't in their tangible workplaces at the moment. Their work is their home. So it's got, I think, some real relevance for the current context we all find ourselves in.
I love that, Ash, in terms of work is such a huge part of our lives, and actually calling out when you look at that wheel and there's all different things that make up well-being, but work serves as such a big chunk of our lives and time. And the other day I was talking to someone and they were saying to me, I work to take holidays. And it's kind of what you were saying before of you work to have a weekend, but it's got to be more than that, because if we're spending 40 plus hours in our job per week, you can't. There has to be more value and purpose that you get from work than just working to take a break. Can you? I guess when I think about well-being, I see so many people who are stressed or they're unhappy or they're disengaged at work, which is a far cry from wellness or well-being. What are some of the barriers that you see to having well-being at work?
Yeah, so we did a lot of research for this book, as you can imagine, being a research agency. So last year we were running lots of surveys, and then we've run a lot of surveys as well this year around COVID and how that's transformed work. So we were able to quickly apply some of those in the final edit of the manuscript before it went to print. And it was really fascinating, I guess, to ask questions of employed Australians. And one question that really was illuminating in terms of what the barriers are for a lot of Australians to them and blockers to them thriving at work. So the number one barrier or blocker was people being overworked and stressed. So 31% of Australians had said that. The next barrier, according to our research, was management structures and hierarchy, followed by leadership, a lack of resources and training, general culture, fellow co-workers, lack of trust and fairness, lack of clear direction and vision, job insecurity, and a focus on profitability. So just what I listed then, that was in order of the responses of Australians. So yeah, it was really interesting to see so many areas aside from the kind of the big one with people being overworked and stressed by their workloads or their role, really a lot of them focused on leadership. And we look at other ones in the book and in this whole chapter about barriers to work well-being around, you know, burnout, that the toxic workplaces, too much of a focus on return on investment if leaders are really focused on that bottom line but not on the culture or the community of a workplace, a lack of trust, which many leaders have had to overcome over the last few months with whole workplaces and workforces, you know, working remotely and trusting people are getting the work done. And also the kind of idea of well-being programs can actually be a bit of a barrier to well-being. And what I mean by that is, you know, that Band-Aid solution. And, you know, there's some really interesting stories of workplaces who go, oh, we'll provide everything for you. We'll provide dry cleaning and sleep pods and dinner services so that you don't ever have to leave. So that's that kind of idea. And that's not helpful for our well-being either.
They don't tell you the so you don't have to ever leave bit though. They just tell you we're going to offer you all these wonderful things. And then the consequence that you find yourself in is, you're right, Ash, you don't leave. And there are a few particularly big brands that have all those perks in inverted commas. So many of what you just rattled off, so many of those, as you've pointed out, do relate to leadership. I'm curious to understand from your perspective, what role does leadership play in this? So for example, if I'm an employee turning up to work, is work well-being my responsibility, or is it the responsibility of the leaders? And then perhaps if we might just sort of dovetail into understanding what can people actually do about work well-being in order to improve it?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and definitely some of the feedback we've got when we've presented some of this research and this data is leaders going, is it just on us? Is it just the responsibility on us to make sure that everyone is well and their well-being is prioritized? And so much of our well-being happens outside of work, like our family relationships and our physical health. So, I mean, for us, the research with employed Australians, we asked this question, who do you think the responsibility of work well-being falls to? And more than 80% of employed Australians said it's the leader's responsibility. And then leaders look at us with the wide eyes and the fear and things like that. So that's what employed Australians are saying. And we do believe that leaders have a responsibility to employ, I guess, and implement structures and things that better the work well-being of their teams. We know that leadership can be a real barrier to people thriving at work, which the research show, but can also be a real enabler to people thriving at work. And there's lots of things leaders can do. I mean, leaders can make or break a workplace culture. They set the tone and the mood of workplaces often, and people are looking to them for what behaviors and ways of working or engaging or communicating are acceptable in a workplace. So I think we don't want to make light of their responsibility there, but it doesn't solely fall to them either. Of course, there's different aspects, I think, and that holistic approach to well-being, that there is some onus on the employee to look after that. But also I think, you know, we're seeing, particularly because of COVID, it's not just there's my work life and there's my home life, or my work life and my out of work life. And that kind of work-life balance term has evolved over time to more workplace integration, sorry, work-life integration. And that idea that our work and our life can't be completely separate. I think we need to have boundaries, and we need to make those achievable and sustainable, but also recognizing that, you know, the values that we bring to our work relate from our values outside of work. And, you know, we can't just leave ourselves at home when we get to the office or get to the workplace. We bring that baggage with us. And so leaders who can understand that and look at someone in a holistic setting is really important. And I guess for us, you know, we talk a lot about leadership in the book, that the largest chapter in the book is on leadership. And so hopefully in that book, there's some really helpful strategies for people to, especially leaders, to feel empowered to actually help their people have well-being at work, not just think it's just my responsibility and what can I do and be overwhelmed by that.
Do you mind giving us a hint on maybe what one of those strategies are, maybe your favorite strategy? Can you share that with us as a teaser to reading the book perhaps?
Yeah, so one aspect and a term that we've kind of coined, and it has come out of some research that Mark has been doing particularly. He's doing a doctorate in leadership at the moment, and that feeds a lot into the book. And he's coined this new term that we really flesh out in the book called empowering leadership. It kind of evolves from servant leadership, and it's looking at how can leaders empower their teams, because we know that, I guess, again, contrary to what maybe a lot of people think, when you think about well-being, perhaps people are thinking it's about yoga and mindfulness and a state of relaxation or comfort. And those things are important. Rest is important, like work is important. But well-being, particularly when we're at work, talking about our vocation and purpose, it's also about us learning and growing, especially for millennials, for the emerging generations at the beginning of their careers who are looking for engagement, training, professional development, opportunity. And so we look at different leadership styles in the book and leading different generations. But one area that seems to transcend all of them is that empowering leadership style. And at Macruna, we're all about alliteration. And so we've developed these three E's around empowering leadership. And the first E is to encourage. So leaders, and I personally think this can be not just for leaders, but anyone in an organization can apply this, whatever level you're at. So the first step is to encourage and to see something in someone and to speak that over them and to speak that into them and to encourage. And the second E as part of empowering leadership is to not just say something nice, but to actually equip them. So if we just bolster people up with words, but there's no training, they'll fall down, and failure is an important part of the process. But the third E is to then actually entrust people with responsibility. And that's really what we try and do at McCrindle. And that's been my journey of growth. You know, I've had opportunities, and Mark, I remember, you know, early on in my career saying, I reckon you could do some speaking and speak at conferences. And I was like, you're kidding. There's no way. You know, and then he was like, no, I believe that you'd be great at it. And then it wasn't just empty words. He actually gave me opportunities and gave me some training. So that empowering leadership, I think, is one way we can improve the well-being of our teams. And that's to encourage, equip, and entrust them with opportunities and opportunities for growth particularly.
I love that, Ash, of the entrusting a person to grow and stretch, and that actually fosters a sense of well-being where you're given opportunity to kind of get out of your comfort zone. In the book, you talk about that there's catalysts for growth. Can you unpack those for me? Because I found that really insightful of well-being's not just about relaxation, it's about growth. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it is that idea that, again, particularly when we're leading younger generations, you know, we often say people aren't looking for a job, they're looking for an opportunity. And it is and in our research, we've constantly over the years found that when we're talking about things that attract people to a workplace, if there is opportunity for advancement or development, that's really key. And I think a catalyst for growth, a catalyst around well-being, is the opportunity to step out of your comfort zone, to try something new. And, you know, that's really what we're seeing with the emerging generations, particularly who, you know, they might not leave a job because there's a compelling reason to leave, but because there's no compelling reason to stay. And that relates to purpose of an organization, which we unpack in the book as well, but also this culture of people having opportunities to step out of their comfort zone and to do something. And I love that quote from Richard Branson. I think we put it in the book, who said, you know, if there's a great opportunity and you don't think you should do it, that's when you know you should do it. Because I think so many, and particularly as a young female, I know from my experience, it can be, I'm not ready, or I'm plagued with insecurity or doubt, but actually, or I don't have all the skills or all the qualifications to do something, so I'm not going to try. But we need to be, you know, leaders and people in our workplaces who give opportunities and encourage us to do things that are going to enable us to grow. And yeah, growth is a really big part of well-being. Again, it's not just this relaxing state of sort of comfort, again, which is still important to have times of rest, but also to push ourselves to grow. And that's, I think, a really key part of what people are looking for in their work as well, job variety, training and development, all those opportunities which leaders can really enable the well-being of their teams if they have a focus on that.
And interestingly, that in itself, this idea of moving outside of your comfort zone, so much of that is wrapped up in the individual's willingness to do that. Because as a leader, you can make all the offers you like, but unless that individual jumps, you know, 2 feet in and says, all right, let's give this a go. And to your credit, Ash, you've told your story of how you've done that with your leader Mark's support and empowerment. Are there any other strategies that come to mind for you in regards to what an individual can do? So where they're not a leader, but they do have a responsibility for their own work well-being, what would you suggest?
So we have this well-being equation within the book, and it's kind of an engagement equation, a well-being equation. And I think leaders will do well to look at that and evaluate their workplaces based on that. But also an individual can look at that and see, you know, what are they doing to enhance their own well-being in the workplace, but also the well-being of others. And that well-being equation is what we call CPI, so culture, purpose, and impact. And that idea that culture is sort of the how you do things, the purpose is why you exist, and the I is for impact. So it's celebrating the wins. And I think for us, this is something that we developed a while ago, and we've been presenting and getting feedback on, and then we tested a whole bunch of things in our research for the book, but also we try and live as much as we can, of course, of the book out in our own workplace. And it's been really fascinating because we do lead quite a young team at MacRindle, and yeah, it's really interesting to see people take ownership of their own well-being in this way, in the CPI sort of well-being equation. So what are you doing to enhance, you know, the organizational culture around the community, around working with other people, you know, and that can be really obvious things like, you know, celebrating team birthdays or, you know, having moments of fun in the workplace or stopping, which is what our research has shown a lot of people are actually missing when working from home or working in isolation. So having a culture and a community of people working together and then purpose. So, you know, people can constantly think and evaluate, what am I doing at the moment every day that contributes to our organization's purpose? And I guess I think really a big part of the CPI equation is the impact. And it's not probably as commonly used in conversations with leaders because culture and purpose are often things we talk about a lot. But the I part is the impact. And I think that's really key because it can also prevent or stop people from burning out. So if people, not to take advantage of workers, of course, but if people know how their hard work is contributing to that purpose and they're being celebrated for it, they're being championed. Like for us at MacRindle, we try and start our weekly team meetings. We have 2 weekly team meetings as a whole team. And every week we try and start those by celebrating the wins of the team and sharing that. And it's a culture moment and it links to the purpose, but we're also celebrating that and where people have been challenged or had opportunities for growth, which we're trying to do that. And, you know, individuals, leaders try and be intentional about that in our workplace, but individuals often will talk about it. So I think evaluating the CPI equation and looking for areas that people can contribute to the culture, can remind people of the purpose, and can celebrate the impacts as a team, but also for you individually. That's hopefully something, and we've had a lot of feedback that people really enjoy that and can find that a practical way that they can hopefully enhance their well-being at work.
I love that of understanding the impact, because you're right. I think we do focus on culture and purpose in a business context, but so often we forget the impact we're having because we just move on to the next project, the next task, the next action. But taking a moment to pause as a team, and I think for anyone listening, if you are an individual contributor, you might not be in a leadership role, you can still foster that in your team meeting context by calling it out. You don't have to be the manager of the team to draw attention to the wins. How, Ash, do you do that in your business context and at McCrindle? Are there things that you do to celebrate the success of other people practically that would help some of our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So I try and do that as much as possible. And, you know, for us at McCrindle, we try and live out lots of principles. And one of those is that empowering leadership, where we're giving opportunities to people. And I remember one given to me was to start doing media interviews. And it was a few years ago. And Mark said, you know, Channel 7 wants someone. They always want Mark oftentimes. And he said, I want you to go and do it. And I was like, oh, okay. And media is very like last minute. You know, it's not a week's notice. It's not even 24 hours notice. It's come in this afternoon to talk about this new research that someone else has done. We want a social commentator to talk about it. So I remember going through that experience myself. And then now I get to sort of train and coach and give opportunities to other team members as the communications director. So that's really fun. And I think for me, I try and, you know, highlight those people, those wins in a, I guess, a relaxed setting around our, you know, weekly team meetings, just to, you know, bring out the achievements of other people, or to encourage people. Or if I see something, you know, someone's worked really hard on something, or they've put in a lot of hours, just to voice that so that they feel like there's a little bit of recognition, which again, we know the emerging generations are looking for in the workplace, as I think, to be honest, all of us are, even the older generations, to be acknowledged for good things that we do, or good work or output that we do. But then that can also be like, for me, I'm such a millennial. I love GIFs and memes, and obviously they're not always appropriate. But sometimes a team email with a GIF or a meme in it, making sure everyone on the email is internal, not external, just, you know, encouraging someone or bringing that positivity can, I think, be something that creates those moments of relief. Because we work really hard at McCrindle. We've got a really diligent, you know, we've got a really big purpose. We've got diligent workers. And I think our team leaders are really conscious of people not burning out, because people also care about the work they're doing. And I think that's something leaders have got to be careful of. When there is a big purpose, people put in the discretionary effort, which is fantastic, but you want to be rewarding that. You want to be acknowledging that and looking after your team members as well, and going, it's time to go home. Like, put the tools down, pick it up tomorrow. Let's have rest, yeah. Go home, go be with your family, all those other elements of well-being. So trying to keep that in mind, I think, is something I'm really conscious of, especially after writing a book on it.
Yeah, that's right. You'll have the book on your desk reminding you every day to be celebrating the wins. It's funny because it sounds really simple in theory of, you know, flick someone an email or just say something in passing of congratulating someone on something they've done. But it's actually takes a lot of intentionality, because I think we get sucked into the negativity at work and solving problems, and that can be our primary focus. But actually coming back up and going, you know what, celebrating and encouraging and recognizing the achievement of the team is countercultural, and it is important and makes a difference. So I love how you've just talked that through, Ash. On the flip side of that, a lot of our listeners reach out to us about working in a toxic culture and what do you do when you're in a toxic environment. You shared with us before that culture has a huge impact on well-being. Can you just unpack that a bit for us?
When there is a culture of toxicity in a workplace that you don't have as much control over, I definitely empathize with people who are going through that, because that can be really challenging. I think part of it is do all you can to, you know, have control over your own work, what you're doing for work, and to encourage and empower and build up the people around you and to celebrate the wins. But I think over time, if that doesn't go away, if that workplace is really toxic and it's causing a lot of burnout and stress and mental health, anxiety, depression, if it's impacting you consistently outside of work for elongated periods of time. You know, Mark and I were discussing this the other day. We're like, is it too harsh to give the recommendation to leave? And we were actually like, no, because we really believe that we spend too much time at work and with the people we work with to put up for that for a long time. So hopefully that's not coming across as I just had a bad day at work, time to go, which is, you know, I think the concern for a lot of leaders leading the emerging generations who are more job mobile. You know, we say they're going to have 18 jobs across 6 careers in their lifetime. So, you know, I often talk about attracting and retaining the emerging generations in keynotes and workshops, and you get this bewildered look of employers going, oh my gosh, what if I invest in training teams and they just leave? And I empathize with that too. But I think there is an element of going, evaluating your work and looking at it and going, is this contributing to my well-being overall, or is it really inhibiting that? And if it's not contributing to it, maybe it is time to look elsewhere, because it does play too big a part in our lives for us to just accept subpar, you know, work and cultures and how we're treated. So that's what we believe. And yeah, hopefully people aren't at that point and they can do things to enhance that and speak to leaders and speak up and build relationships with people. But if it's not working, then I think maybe move on and find somewhere that does value you, that does value your contribution, where you can grow, you can be challenged, the boundaries are respected, you can work hard and do good work.
What was the most unexpected piece of research?
One of the areas that I kept sort of coming back to was people being skeptical of the idea of work well-being and just going, is it just a nice to have this airy-fairy idea of well-being versus an actual, return on investment, because it does require an investment of the individual and particularly the employer or the leader. And we know that, again, particularly in the current environment, there's a lot of pressure on workplace leaders to output more with less. There's a lot of, things that people are trying to juggle. And it's nice that workplaces can be a great culture, but workplaces and organizations also need to make money if they want to survive. So there needs to be an element of profitability or KPIs. So we wanted to sort of not just have this really altruistic, aspirational book, but something that gave some strategies and some practical ways that people can enhance the well-being of themselves and their teams, but also to paint the picture and to make the case that it does correlate to positive outcomes and it does affect the bottom line. And we found that it does.
That's so good, Ash, because one of the things business leaders care about is the bottom line. And so you mentioned before that in the drive towards profitability can actually detract from well-being. But if businesses can flip the model and say, actually, if we build up the well-being of our staff and organization and focus on that, that's actually going to drive those return, that ROI and that bottom line and enhance business performance. I think there's a good point in there for you, if you're listening today, to be thinking through when you're trying to sell the business case for well-being, that it's not just, sometimes business leaders care more about the money and the financial performance then about people. And so we acknowledge that it's sad, but it is true. And I guess that's why this book is important, because it's helping us to shift some of that. But maybe having that conversation with your leader to talk about the business case for how well-being links to the profitability and business performance. Are there things in the book that people can use as part of that conversation with their leader, Ash, to kind of, I guess, advocate for that?
Yeah, take a copy of the book to the meeting. But I think also, I think the research is probably something that I hope people feel equipped with if they are the person in their team at whatever level of, you know, organizational structure or hierarchy or leadership that they fall into. If they do see and they're convinced that this is really important, which I hope they are. And to your point as well around, you know, people are an organization's greatest asset. And so when leaders can acknowledge that and foster that, then we have a place for people to thrive and for the organization to thrive. And then at a really macro level for societies to thrive, if we have more organizations, prioritizing that. But I think for us, and this is probably coming from my bias as a researcher, because I guess if people and bosses and leaders are focusing on that ROI aspect and the profitability, then hopefully it's the hard evidence-based data that speaks their language. And we've got that in the book. We've got lots of data. We've got lots of tables and graphs that we hopefully explain in a really engaging way that can help make that case and can, you know, maybe it's read chapter, X and look at the pages I've tabbed, because this is the case. And this is the difference around all those different elements for attracting and retaining great people in this organization. And I think the other thing for me, you know, that's the quantitative, the hard data, the facts, but there's also the qualitative, the stories, and the power of stories. That was basically my whole TED talk that I delivered a couple of years ago, is the power of storytelling. And we draw on a lot of stories in the book from leaders in the corporate space, in the not-for-profit space, leaders that we know and have worked with, that we respect and we look up to, and to tell those stories. And I think they're two really compelling ways that you can convince someone or make a case for something, by looking at the hard data and the facts, but also at the stories. And if people feel comfortable about being vulnerable and sharing with the people in their teams that they work with or their leaders, you know, the impact that a lack of a commitment to well-being might be having on them, or vice versa, a positive story of a commitment to well-being, that can hopefully be something that we've equipped people with in this book to, yeah, make a positive change, or encourage someone else in their organization to make a positive change around work well-being.
So good. So for people who are listening today that want to be able to do that little bit of a self-assessment of where they're at in their own well-being, how can you kind of gauge? I know you talked about that concept of thriving at work rather than just kind of surviving. Can you talk to us a bit about that, about how you can assess where you're at in your own work well-being?
I think, again, drawing back on some of the research that we did, and it's interspersed throughout the book, but, you know, we've got questions in there, we've got graphs in there, and I think it is a bit of a self-assessment tool without it formally being the case or labeled the case in the actual book. But, you know, we ask the question, how do you feel when you wake up? Like, how do you typically feel most of the time when you wake up on a Monday morning and the work week ahead is before you? And is it, I'm excited and I can't wait to get into it? Is it, I'm mostly excited, but, you know, I'm a bit daunted by the workload or whatever, or I dread it and I'm, you know, I just want to stay in bed. And of course, you know, there's times where we just want to do that, even if we love our job, even if we love our work, if it's raining outside, or if you do have something that, you know, is an outlier in your work load in the week and it's causing you a bit of anxiety or concern. But I think using some of those questions that are located throughout the book and just evaluating where you sit in that. And I think that might be something. I think something else is to build greater well-being at work is to look at that well-being wheel and just to evaluate where you're at on each of those different elements, and thinking about what you're doing, writing down perhaps what you're doing to enhance that. And I remember I was at a conference recently, and somebody, it was a workplace wellbeing conference, and it was part of the research for the book. And I went, and there was like 21 speakers across 2 days. It was a lot. So it was this deep, immersive conference. And one of the speakers was fantastic. And he was talking about how, one of the key roles and the key things people can do for their well-being holistically is to go home from work on time. And it was just really simple, but the way he explained it was, when you stay at work late, you get home late, you have dinner late, you minimize the time spent with family, you go to bed late, you get up early, and then it repeats itself. And I think sleep is something that I've learned a lot about for the book. And even so many of us working in the knowledge economy, where we need to be creative and cognitive. And that's the thing that our research found most people are giving up. It's not exercise, it's actually sleep. We'll go to bed late, we'll get up early to exercise. And then, you know, we feel like that's the right priority, but actually sleep impacts so much of our physical health, as well as our mental capacity, our mental health. And so I think that's really one practical thing people can do.
We love finishing on the practical. So you've beaten us to it in providing that piece of advice, which makes so much sense. Would there be one other thing that you could suggest that's just as practical for leaders specifically, that they can turn up to work and start doing in order to increase work well-being for the people that they're responsible for?
Yeah, I think one thing is, I think a lot of the time, you know, leaders are doing lots of things. Of course, they've got a lot of responsibility and they're doing lots of things, and they might think they have a gauge on where their teams are at, but I wonder, and I sometimes sort of question whether they do. And I hope that leaders are checking in with their people regularly, whether that's one-on-one catch-ups. Of course, it depends how big the team is and the sort of structures that are in place. But I think, again, this is probably me speaking as a researcher coming out, but maybe it is about, you know, doing a little staff survey or an engagement survey. And it's a really simple thing, but it can give, you know, a de-identified aspect for people to give feedback and to actually get a gauge. I think for us, research tests and confirms or denies hypothesis. And I think oftentimes, I'm sure we've all listeners have been involved where a leader, you know, a leader in their organization or wherever it might be thinks they're doing a great job, but everyone else is going, I don't know about that. We're all pretty disengaged. We're all experiencing that presenteeism where they're, you know, they're physically present, but mentally not engaged in the work or in the culture. So I think that's one area, and just to get feedback from people. And I guess part of that as well is to let people speak into that conversation and speak into the solution, because when we do that, we give people ownership and they're more likely to be involved in that solution rather than a leader just going, this is how we're going to do things from now on. So asking the questions and that kind of Stephen Covey of seeking first to understand, then to be understood, and to understand where your people are at so that you can respond and bring them on the journey of that and not just sort of dictate, because that's that hierarchical command and control leadership style that we talk a lot about in the book, as we've moved away from towards more of that collaborative and contributive leadership style where people are involved in the solution, their voices can feel heard in the organization. And yeah, that contributes to greater ownership of whatever the leader can implement, I think. So hopefully there's some practicals that leaders can implement as well.
There's so much value in what you've described of work well-being actually has a huge impact on our personal lives, on our health, on our effectiveness at work. But I also love that for those who are business leaders, business owners, it actually drives value and profitability for the business as well. So it's got huge benefits. Ashley, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to us today. It's a real privilege for us to have you on the show, and we so appreciate all that you've spoken about. So Ash, tell us, how do we find more out about the book? Where do we go?
So we've set up a little website that's just hopefully makes it really easy for people to find the book, to engage with different resources. And that's just simply workwellbeing.com.au. So there's a link to a bit of a blurb about the book, link to Mark and I, and also a link to a virtual event that we ran a couple of weeks ago, launching the book. So people can watch that, that for free if they're interested. And then of course they can buy the book there as well.
Beautiful. Well, make sure you jump on, buy the book and watch the virtual webinar. Great to have you hanging out with us. Thanks so much, Ash.
Thank you so much for taking the time to share. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
See ya.
We acknowledge the Darkin Young people, traditional custodians of the land on which our studio sits, and pay respect to their elders, past and present. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to our podcast.